What would a year without war sound like to you? Would it sound like this? Or would it sound like this? Or would it sound like this? Or would it sound like this? Sounds great, doesn't it? Then go to ayearwithoutwar.org to find out how you can support 2020, A Year Without War.
And that's our subject for today's program, A Year Without War. We have Joe White in the studio with us. He's the founder, the visionary. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And if I can get a little impromptu, what did you think of the little 30-second piece that we had there at the front of the program?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? What will that be like? What would the year be like? It's a complicated question.
It really is, and we're going to get into that because we're going to try to touch upon each of the various elements regarding the change. I came across a gentleman who wrote a book called ED, After Disclosure. It's more dealing with extraterrestrials and what if the government revealed, yes, they're out there, it's real. And my first question to him would be, if I were ever to interview the gentleman, okay, let's just say for the sake of argument, what makes you think the public is going to believe the government because they've been lying to us all this time? How do you know they're not lying now? You know, kind of thing. This has nothing to do with the government in the sense that we don't care what the government is saying. We care what they're doing. We care what the people of the countries of the world are doing and encouraging them to, and correct me if I'm wrong, raise the consciousness of the world to a level where even if it is only for 365 short little days, once, so be it. At least we had that much. Well, I heard a statistic, and you may have a better grasp on this than I. I heard a statistic that said that over the course of human history, man has only experienced several hundred years of peace over the thousands of years that he's been here.
You know, I've heard statistics to that effect as well, but kind of what puzzles me is I don't know how people get that information.
I wonder, too.
You know, there wasn't an internet for that long and the kind of tracking that goes on now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even when you read just the Old Testament, you see how the Middle East was settled after the Exodus out of Egypt, supposedly. You know, just constant war there, and I don't know who's gathering all that information. That's just a small part of the world.
Now, there are certain elements of this that are sort of irrelevant in terms of why these people in various parts of the world are fighting. Those issues don't seem to be all that relevant. You're looking for, in a manner of speaking, and we just went through the holidays, you're sort of looking for that Christmas miracle from World War One. You've heard the story.
Oh, yes. Coming up on Christmas Eve, 1914.
Yeah, 1914. And so we are looking at, again, we're trying to do this over a course of an entire year. Your goal is, your target date, if you will, or target year is 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting that you've chosen the old adage, hindsight is 2020.
Mm-hmm.
2020 is perfect vision, as they say.
And that's how it grew out of this. It was originally 2020 Vision of Hope, A Year Without War.
Okay.
But as it started to grow, people kept saying, it's just way too long. Cut it down. Get to the core of it. So it became 2020, A Year Without War, because 2020 also at the time gave us about 8 years to build the community that we're trying to build, which will consist of at least 800 million people globally engaged and dedicated to the many programs we have unfolding.
Are you familiar with any of the science surrounding the connectivity of mankind around the globe? One particular organization called HeartMath.
Mm-hmm.
They have these devices planted all over the globe, and they had them prior to even 9/11. And when they went back to take a look at the data from these different devices following 9/11, they noticed that there was a global shift in energy. I think it was, if not moments, maybe an hour prior to the actual events that we now refer to as 9/11. It was as if the consciousness of the planet knew, humanity knew something
Well, I'm not familiar with that, yeah. But I would like to follow it up if you have some specific references. And, you know, we're building a community yeah. that's going to involve a whole variety of positions, because what we're trying to realize is that at this point, and this will probably rub people in a peculiar way, but I think one of our challenges is coming to terms with inevitable pluralism. And we have to realize that very smart, reasonable people that are well-informed disagree about some profound issues. And if we can just accept that and find stability in our diversity, then we can eliminate war as a means of traditional conflict resolution. Because we've gotten to a point now where, as you alluded to a moment ago, you know, people have these sorts of disagreements that I'm finding with the students I deal with, since I'm a professor at SBCC, the millennial generation that's come along, they're much more tolerant than previous generations. And I think that at this point, that generation could serve as a spark to kind of get this going, because they do want to travel the world. Mm-hmm. They have more passports. I think American millennials have more passports now than previous generations have had. And when I ask them in a class, what would you do if you suddenly got a little chunk of change here, if you inherited something? Most of them want to travel. They want to see the world. And so they're tolerant. They want to get out. They tend to be cosmopolitan. And they don't understand the source of many of the traditional wars that we've had. You know, I mean, we have really problematic people like ISIS right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But those sorts of people would become comparable are similar to the sort of people that now continue to trade in slaves. There's supposedly, 20 million some odd slaves on Earth right now. Even though it's illegal everywhere,
yeah.
It's just not an institutionalized, socially accepted practice anymore to show up in Philadelphia and see if somebody's got slaves to sell. And so that's how we want to push war. We want to push it so that it becomes primarily criminal activity, and it's thuggish mm-hmm. at that point, because at this juncture, when you look at what's being expended, especially this first decade with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq on the part of the United States, it's not clear that things were left better than they were, but yet we've managed to nearly bankrupt ourselves as a result of that. So there's got to be another way of resolving the sort of conflicts that we have, and this program is just an attempt to push it in that direction. Our success isn't dependent upon the year 2020 being a complete year without war and us having 800 million people at our site. Suppose we make it to 100 million, and suppose the wars, which are fairly isolated right now, and the sense of there being other great state wars like we saw with World War I and World War II seems to be diminishing. But if we get to over 100 million people and there's still some of these, just these nasty little conflicts, like what's it been 60 some odd years now for Israel and Palestine, mm-hmm. that we will have brought to the planet the opportunity for people to think about this, and will be the probably one of the most popular organizations on Earth at the time, which yeah. means we'll get to do a lot of radio shows, yeah. a lot of TV shows, yeah. and talk to a lot of people. And so maybe like the abolition of slavery in the 19th century, when that started getting hold, you know, there's going to be bumps in this road. But that war can serve as a means of inevitable conflict resolution for human beings? No, that's the question that we want to raise. Let's seriously look at this and see if there are other methods that we can use, particularly arbitration. I mean, we have wonderful arbitration methods in international courts.
What is the definition that you look at when you talk about war? What is war?
Well, that's a very tricky question, and it's right up there with what is a chair. It's one of those. War is a concept where when it's going on, it's fairly easy to recognize cases of that. But it's an open textured concept. It's open in a like chair or game or one of these concepts. It's not like being a triangle or being a bachelor. Mm-hmm. It doesn't admit of those kinds of precise definitions. But you know that there are people when you see them that you can say, well, this person is not bald. And you can look at this person and say, well, this person is bald. And then there are the difficult cases in the middle.
Yeah.
So one doesn't want to get distracted over the difficult cases. And we're certainly not concerned with the war on poverty. And the war on drugs really isn't one of our issues. Mm-hmm. But again, you go back to using the word bald, and you see that there are going to be difficult cases, but no bald eagle is bald.
Yeah.
So these concepts, you know, they're complex in terms of their kind of logical geography, how they work. And so, you know, right now we know that Palestine and Israel have been locked in a war. We know that ISIS is involved with war in Syria and Iraq. We know that we were at war in Iraq. We know that we were at war in Afghanistan. We know that there are problems with the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, which end up in warlike arrangements. So that's what we want to stop. Let's see if we just can't find a way of stopping that sort of activity.
I have to say that in my brief stint on this planet of 55 years, 54 and a half, if you will, I have done a great deal of observation. And you used an interesting phrase in dealing with specifically in talking about Afghanistan and, you know, are they better off today than they were when the whole thing started? And of course, Reagan raised that same question when he was running for office. You know, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And I look at the way things have unfolded over, you know, you talk about Israel and Palestine and they've been fighting. And I watched the Camp David Accords. And part of me in my observations sees that we don't want to solve the problem. Because if we did, we would have solved the problem by now. But every president since, I can't even remember when, well, obviously since Israel became a state in 47, every president has tried to resolve that conflict, and they can't. And I have to wonder, either A, we don't want to solve it, or B, we can't solve it. It's not ours to solve. Keep your mitts off. It's not our problem. And I'm wondering about these various conflicts around the world. Is it kind of like a forest fire, a wildfire that's raging, and it's out of control? There's nothing you can do to stop it. And you almost kind of have to, gonna have to let it burn until winter, until the snows come. Do we try to intervene in these situations and try to, before, you know, by 2020, again, I know that, that 2020 isn't a magical number and a magical year, but from your perspective, do we try to intervene or do we try to let them figure it out or eventually maybe just annihilate one another and then it's over?
Well,
which is a sad way, sad, very sad way to go.
Yes. And as you pointed out, you know, it seems like every president we've had since Truman, you know, has tried to deal with these conflicts in the Middle East, and they just seem to go on and on and on.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the distinctions that A Year Without War has, is this isn't a top-down organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bottom-up organization. And I think now, one of the last surveys that I'd heard was that a majority of the Israelis would like to see some solution here, some two-state solution. And the way A Year Without War is working, trying to get at least 800 million, is to hit a social tipping point. Because these social processes for humans, birds when they're flying, and fish when they're in schools, it's usually a minority that turns the majority. And my sense now with the Israeli and Palestinian conflict is that they're the conservative minorities that are keeping the conflict at such a high level. And back when Clinton had Arafat in those negotiations, and it seemed to come down to Arafat. I mean, he was the one stickler in that whole, and it comes down to these minority positions. What we're hoping is that now with this brand new technology, this internet, you know, that you can actually give voice to the masses.
It's like the Egyptian Spring, I think it was, that they called it a couple of years ago.
Yeah, or the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then went into Egypt.
That's kind of what you're talking about.
Well, exactly. You know, when it started in Tunisia, it started with all these young people on their social media. And they lost control of it. And I think just yesterday they've elected a new president, which is 88. He's 88 years old and kind of old school. But we'll see what he does. But it's these young people who at that time were saying, we just want rule of law. We want to respect pluralism, and we want democratic processes. I think if we could put those three elements in place socially, you would end up with stability. And not that you wouldn't have conflict, but if you come to our website, one of our blogs is titled Democracies for Losers. And what it was arguing was that if you're going to live in a democracy, you've got to be willing to lose a vote because it's the process. Mm-hmm. Because democracy mm-hmm. grows out of the recognition that really smart, intelligent, insightful people just disagree over profound things. So let's put it to a vote. You talk about these kinds of wars that seem to be constantly going on, but if you go back to the 16th century and the 17th century in Europe, you had these deep political religious wars that were constantly dividing countries. But to think that Lutherans are going to attack Catholics now, or there are going to be those kinds of religious wars between Protestants and Catholics, it just almost seems unthinkable in the West at this point. So we're just 2020, a year without war, is really just a kind of exclamation point for humanity. My understanding is that the International Olympic Committee has been successful for over 20 years now, getting truces through the United Nations signed unanimously by all countries in the United Nations, that during the Olympics there will be a truce. There won't be war, which is part of the tradition of ancient Greece. And as you know, in September of 2001, the United Nations created September 21st as the International Day of Peace. And so there's a movement here wanting to get closer to realizing that everybody can thrive, live longer lives, and have healthier children if we can just stop this violence against each other. And now we've gotten to the point where the millennials know this so well. We have collective global problems we're dealing with. Without arguing over what the cause of global warming is, the planet's getting warmer. And as that gets warmer, that's going to increase the potential for conflict. Yeah. So we've got to get together and deal with sustainability issues, with poverty issues. And there's supposedly over $2 trillion a year spent by the global militaries. And it takes, the next 14 countries after the United States, you put all their defense budgets together, which includes China and Russia and Britain and France, and so the prominent nations in a sense in the world right now, and they don't add up to the U.S. defense budget. So there's a ton of treasure and an awful lot of blood being spent annually on us killing each other as a species, while the planet we're on is changing, and we've got collective issues to deal with, and we have the capital, as it were, to start to deal effectively with these issues. We just have to stop killing each other.
I was watching one of the videos on the website that did a little breakdown as far as, for example, a stealth bomber would pay for X number of college educations, and a tank would pay for, and it would go through these kinds of things. So let me ask you, in regards to how a year without war, from your visionary perspective, how would our economic system change in just that 1 year?
Probably very little with regard to that, with regard to the military-industrial complex. I mean, fortunately for us, our program is so simple. Mm-hmm. This is often what eludes people, is that we're just trying to bring about 1 year global ceasefire, just for 1 year. We don't have to unravel the military-industrial complex. It's not part of our program. And on our program, too, as we've made this, it's nonpartisan, it's not religious, and it's not a peace movement. Peace is really complicated. This is probably where we would veer from somebody like John Lennon. Mm-hmm. He played, all we are saying is give peace a chance. Mm-hmm. That's way beyond us. Mm-hmm. All we're saying is stop fighting for just 1 year. So we have a deadline, we have an expiration date, and we have a quantifiable goal of at least 800 million people that we hope to get engaged. And right now, our goal is when we were up, we got this launched, and last year we started polling in people. So we had about 3,000 people from over 70 nations. Well, if we're going to hit our goal, we have to grow by 10 times each year. And fortunately, a year later, I can say now we're over 30,000 followers, and we have people from over 120 nations. So our goal next year is 300,000 followers. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy. I mean, you can get involved in a whole variety of ways with our program. But the first thing is just go and sign up for our newsletter at our website and like us on Facebook and follow us on whatever social media you're comfortable with. We have a lot of social media up there so we can build this community. And you determine your level of involvement. You can get quite involved. We've already locally gotten proclamations of support from local cities like Santa Barbara, Carpinteria, and the first one was Lompoc. And for your listeners, they don't know, Lompoc is kind of dwarfed by Vandenberg Air Force Base. So that was a nice one to get. And we have two national veterans groups that have partnered with us. Mm-hmm. So we're just trying to grow this out and say, let's look at ourselves as this species now with this unique opportunity to communicate and build this global community and tell us, you know, how many of you want this to stop? And let's see where we go.
Now, you said that this movement, A Year Without War, 2020, A Year Without War, is beyond peace. And yet everything I can recall growing up especially was that the opposite of war was peace. So if you're beyond that, and I am understanding what you're saying, but this is just these questions that come up. If it's not about peace and just the cessation of conflict for that 1 year to start, we hope, then what is it? If it's a year without war, then what is it a year with 2020?
The reason we draw this distinction is that, and sometimes we use the analogy, if you've known people, couples who are in a rather nasty, battering relationship, and comes every Saturday night, sure enough, it starts up again, and you hear it in the yelling and the punching and the whatever. If you think of humanity in that way, what we're asking for is just take that Saturday night off. Let's not do it that Saturday night. Will they live in peace? I don't even know if they'll talk to each other. But we just want the fight. Let's just see if we can get the fighting to stop. And there are thousands of peace organizations out there, and we hope to partner with all of them because right now all of that energy is rather diffuse. So we want to bring it all to focus on this 1 year. And if we can just get the fighting to stop, then maybe we can start to grow the circumstances, which would be peaceful circumstances, under which human beings have the opportunity to thrive. But the first step for us is not to shoot for the thriving. And you know, peace, you listen to so many peace songs and what people are doing. It's just more complex than stopping the fighting. And so we're just trying to keep this very simple. Yeah. And the reason we're doing it for 1 year is because when you look at so many other organizations and they're trying to bring peace or trying to eliminate, I don't know, something or rather big, it almost just takes the breath out of you. Mm. So we think that if we could just keep this very, very simple, maybe we can actually come to agreement that for 365 days in the year 2020, people will stop. And let's just see what that's like.
Okay.
And I think that opportunity, that breath, that we've sometimes referred to this in our discussions as a kind of perfect pause in the way in which most of us, most people probably listening in, and you and I have lived in a kind of perfect storm of cold and hot wars for our entire life.
Oh, yeah.
They've been everywhere. And they're not, for me anyway, I I was born after World War II, so I haven't experienced World War the way that was,
right,
or the way it was in between 1914, 1918 with World War I. So I don't have that sense, but I certainly have a sense of that ongoing Cold War between the Soviet Union and United States, where you remember you had the clock heading to midnight, you know, mutually assured destruction and the end of the species and nuclear winter, and, you know, taught how to get under a desk to save yourself in case, you know, a bomb went off. And I remember as a child there being air raid sirens that every Friday they would just test them in the city where I lived or I was growing up. And you would go into your basement for, you know, that would help you. But I remember going to the basement with my mother when the air raid sirens would go on. So what we're trying to do is just say, let's try it for 1 year. Now it's called, and we call it for short, AYWW. Mm-hmm. So if it works in 2020, then we'll do AYWW Part 2, which is simply another year without war.
Exactly.
And I've got a great group of people working with me who are ready to do it year after year after year if we have the infrastructure that we can pull this off.
I think that it's commendable. I think that it certainly is quite simple. It's just stop killing each other.
For one year.
And we're not talking about, we're not asking anybody to change their ideologies, their religious persuasions, their political affiliations. We're not asking them to change their mindsets other than stop for 1 year. Just stop.
Well, let's see what that's like.
I mean, what could it hurt? Because I know I've heard you both on other programs on this station as well as in the videos. Look, after the year is over, if you want to go back to fighting, go ahead, have at it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
In the meantime, let's, again, as you say, because we don't know what that's like.
Yeah.
It's one of the questions that I'm always asking of when I talk to people about the economy and the economic structure that exists both in the United States as well as globally. Who said that this was the only way that it had to be? You know, just because the so-called great minds of the last 100 or 400 or whatever number of years set up all of these various little infrastructures that have grown into this Goliath of an economic system that spans the globe, doesn't mean that that's the only way.
No, and it will change.
And it will change. I mean, and obviously it has changed even in probably the last 150 to 200 years. I mean, there was a point we didn't have a stock market that influenced us. Let's shift a little bit when we're talking about this conflict, which sort of, instead of the word war, you know, it sort of deflates the word is different, conflict versus war, you know. I keep hearing that, what is it, the Funkadelic song, war, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. Conflict, it doesn't have the same oomph, if you will. It doesn't have the same energy, if you will. But that's really what they are. I mean, the war is more the action that's going on the battlefield. But it's because there's this conflict between peoples for whatever the reasons are. You know, and again, maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Well, conflict, it has such a broad spectrum that you and I'm sure we sit here long enough, we'll find that we're in conflict over something about our ideas, mm-hmm, on whatever. I'm not sure. But war grows out of conflict, and it's at that extreme end of conflict. And so our program really sees conflict, all things considered, sees conflict as a kind of richness amongst human beings because there's something creative and unique going on here. And that's why when we started the program off, I said one of the issues that I think we need to come to terms with socially is this notion of pluralism, which is that, again, bright, reasonable people will profoundly disagree over issues. I think religion is key here,
yeah,
and probably economic structures, as you were just talking a moment, mm-hmm, ago as well. So what we see then and how we've configured this is to say that since conflict is inevitable, war is not inevitable because that's a way of resolving certain extreme conflicts. Yeah. And we have structures in place now. I mean, I think if Canada and the United States ended up in some major conflict or something, I just don't see us bombing Ottawa.
Yeah.
Or the Canadians bombing Niagara Falls or something. So, yeah. Because we have structures in place, and this goes on amongst most countries in the world have these kinds of structures in place to resolve these conflicts. So if we can come to terms with pluralism, I think one of the fascinating aspects of that is that pluralism nurtures, and it recognizes and it nurtures variety and variation. And if anything that seems to have come out of contemporary evolutionary biology is that random variation is a good thing. Mm. That's how we adapt as a species and enhances our adaptation. And what human beings need to do is to recognize that variety is more healthful to the species than trying to homogenize it. I mean, we've recognized this in our agriculture. We worry now about monocultures. We know that there have been catastrophes in history where people have relied upon a monoculture. Mm-hmm. And so we want to diversify our agriculture. But when it comes to our own species, for some reason, there's the need on the part of some still, and I think it's been historically the case for most, to homogenize the culture. So at one point in Europe, you know, if you weren't part of this group X, but you're part of Y, then that kind of conflict would lead to war and, you know, torture. I mean, we have such a horrific history of punishing the other, the difference, instead of recognizing. Again, this is all things considered because you're going to have people whose differences are intolerable. I mean, they could be psychopaths or whatever.
Sure.
But those are the minority cases, I think. But now to recognize that kind of variety so that you see that, you know, the varieties of Christians, the varieties of Muslims, the varieties of Jewish people, the varieties of Hindus and Buddhists, this is actually a good thing for humanity. And I think it fits in comfortably with this notion of random variation biologically as well.
Let's talk a little bit about that. In terms of there are some who would say that war, and again, using the differentiation between conflict and war, it just seems to be ingrained in our DNA. And what little I know of the evolutionary process of man specifically, not from something, but man as he has lived on the planet, okay? There are certain aspects of the physical being that have changed, maybe only slightly, but have changed. We now remove wisdom teeth, for example, because we don't need them. We get rid of the appendix because supposedly we don't know what the heck it's for. I don't know. Maybe somebody does know what it's for. I don't know. I am wondering if we have noticed any kind of change in the mental capacity, if you will, even the emotional capacity of man over the centuries. Have we evolved in any way, shape, or form? Or is that even a viable? Is that even a viable conversation? Is that even relevant? Or is this vision you have of 2020, a year without war, sort of maybe part of that evolutionary process to get people's brains to start thinking, going back to that question, what would that be like?
Well, you know, we've never lived in such a globalized world. And some people have argued that this really started with Christopher Columbus and when...
Well, he's to blame for a lot of stuff.
well, not to blame, you know, when peoples so divided since, you know, for 200 million years after Pangaea broke up, you know, and the continent started drifting apart and Homo sapiens just had no contact with each other. But suddenly here come Europeans to North America, that was the spark of globalization, as it were, in this modern period. But now with rapid transportation and instant communication, I mean, we're hardwired as a community. And there are things we know now that force us to rethink. One of the peripheral issues that we've dealt with is the fact that NASA and the European Space Agency do not have the resources to track asteroids much smaller, let's say, than what I think they're categorized as civilization ending or species ending.
Ah.
So those that are fluttering around, like the ones that we had near passes in just this last February, if you remember the one that was predicted and being watched, the one that came between our satellites and the planet, was a substantial asteroid. Would have easily taken out, I think, a city like Los Angeles or London or something. But then the one appeared over Russia the same day from out of nowhere. And that one carried the power of 5 Hiroshima bombs. But fortunately, it skipped off of the atmosphere when it exploded. And so it only sent a few thousand people to the hospital and broke a whole lot of windows. But what I'd read at that time was that I think it was NASA needed about $250 million to test some of the technology that was being developed to kind of push these things along so we didn't have these impacts. But there wasn't money to test this technology.
Yeah.
Yet we're building, what, $14 billion aircraft carriers. So if we're dealing with rocks out there that are civilization ending or species ending or metropolis ending, these are collective things that we're dealing with, which our ancestors never had to deal with. They didn't know these things. And the last thing I would say is that the anthropological and historical evidence isn't unanimous that war has been a part of the human condition. The British historian Jerome Kagan has argued that war is a social phenomenon. It wasn't present amongst hunters and gatherers. And if the rough date of 200,000 years is about the length of our species here, well, we've only been in civilizations roughly 8 to 10,000 years. Mm. So for maybe 190,000 years, there was no war for the species. It's when we had the opportunity to start accumulating treasure, as it were, that other Homo sapiens that weren't settled in that way, that were still hunters and gatherers, moved in, this according to Kagan. So, and there's anthropological arguments to this effect as well. People come to our blog, we've covered some of these and reviewed some of the books that are making this argument. So in that way, war is a kind of social phenomena, and it's social and could be and could go on for this length of time because people were fairly isolated. And, you know, when you look at what Caesar did in Gaul and you think, you know, could that sort of thing, or Genghis Khan, or these kinds of wars, or Attila the Hun, you know, those kinds of wars don't seem to be the sorts of wars that we're dealing with now. But when you look at how these things were conducted in the sort of isolation that occurred at the time, we just don't have that anymore. And so that's why 2020, and your question about are we thinking differently, we're in a whole new era. And the things that we know about the world and about reality just make it that much more complex, which is why we have so much pluralism now and not the homogeneous societies that seem prevalent in the past.
So you're saying that community is sort of inbred. That's part
of social animals.
We are that for a fact.
Actually, I think we're referred to now as ultra social animals.
Okay.
Because we have highly complex divisions of labor, unlike social animals like wolves or horses.
Yeah. In my challenge to bring together two of my dogs who just don't seem to get along. One of them is very territorial and just really wants nothing to do with this other dog. I've been told that if there was a way to take both of these dogs and put them together into a, shall we say, a challenging or even a traumatic experience, not necessarily harmful, but just something that they would automatically forget their conflict with each other, and suddenly now they're going to work together to get out of this mess that they find themselves in. When they come out of that mess, they will be bonded because they've shared this experience. And I'm kind of getting that sense from this conversation that we're having about 2020, a year without war, in that, in a manner of speaking, those of us who aren't fighting, You know, you and I, we're not A, in conflict with one another. We're not involved in a conflict externally from this room that we're chatting in. And yet we are probably both of the same mind that we're kind of tired of this.
War weary.
Yeah. Yeah. And we haven't even been in it, but we keep hearing about it and hearing of it and the aftermath and all of the other aspects to it. And it's like, my gosh, there hasn't been a moment in my life. If I can recall back to birth, there hasn't been a moment since where there hasn't been, and I haven't heard, even just in passing, of something going on somewhere. And it's like, oh my gosh. And you've heard the phrase, waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's almost as if, yeah, you are, but there's no time because there's just this constant chaos.
Well, I would agree with you. And part of what we're trying to do with A Year Without War now is to, and if you come to the website when the show is on, you'll see that we've been developing some themes at our fundraiser that we're involved with. We just launched our first fundraiser at Indiegogo. And you can either go to Indiegogo and look for A Year Without War, or you can just come to our website, A Year Without War, and you'll find our Indiegogo. And what we want to do is allow people like yourself who have supported us now to say, you know, we are war weary. Let's all of us come together and see how large that voice is. And so at this point, if we're successful in this fundraiser, and we're just trying to do it in a kind of economics of scale where we have a lot of people donating a little. So that's why we're just asking you to give us, you know, one of your lunches, or just give us a couple lattes or something. Because if we can get enough people to support this through this kind of sense of war weariness and a recalculation of where their treasure, where their money is going, then we'll have a sustainable staff that can then work with a whole variety of people and bring together in a more effective way the satellite communities we have growing now in Bali and Stockholm and Edinburgh. And we, you know, we want to reach out globally to give voice because we think a majority of the people are just like that. They're war weary. Let's just stop this. What is the nature of the conflict we have here that we have to kill each other? Yeah. And presently, our theme has been to focus on the children. So the great group that we have, the team we have now, has put together, and it's on our social media, just how much of the suffering goes on amongst children. And when you look at the majority of casualties in war, they're not combatants, they're civilians. And when you look at the majority of civilians that die in war, they're usually children. So we just want people to just be aware that, you know, it's the innocent that are primarily suffering, and we're hoping at some point to focus on what happens to animals during all of this. And what's happening to us ecologically when we're doing all this testing of weapons. So, you know, we're trying to give voice to the war weary. And when you brought up the point that, you know, well, what with your dogs, what if they shared some traumatic experience? Would they then in some sense bond and get over these other differences that they have? You know, you can ask yourself, what would have happened in the last Israeli-Hamas war if suddenly that bright star appeared in the skies, much like it did over Russia when people stopped their cars, and from all these their telephones, you got all these interesting photos of this asteroid coming in. And I think if, you know, the Israelis and Hamas and the groups just suddenly looked up and saw this star in the middle of the day and think, well, that thing's getting pretty bright.
Yeah.
It's getting brighter and brighter. Yeah. And then if they were told that in 12 hours, there's a chance, I mean, you're not going to be here anymore. This is going to be one big crater. What would that do to that sort of conflict? But we see it played out dramatically as well. If you remember the film Independence Day, you know, I mean, the theme of that was, look how we've all come together to battle these horrible aliens, you know, and we send one guy up, into the belly of one of these rocket ships, which is basically a suicide bomber.
Yeah.
But now we have a common enemy, and so this suicide bomber becomes a hero to save the species. Nobody ever asked, well, who's on the mothership? Were those people all kidnapped? Are they all evil people?
Yeah.
I mean, who are we killing here and wiping out? You know, those. But it was, you know, it's melodramatic.
Sure, sure.
But to your point, when you have that common trauma that you're facing, which I think these millennials realize, I mean, it's not going to be good if the Arctic keeps melting at the rate that it's melting, there's going to be substantial change in agriculture, in coastal communities, in the resources that we're going to have available to us. So let's come together here and recognize the commonness that we've created now with our technology, with this global community. We're no longer isolated. And let's take the treasures of blood and capital, and let's just try to fix the problems that we're now facing collectively.
Joe White's my guest. He is the founder, the executive director, and the visionary of 2020, A Year Without War. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We come your way every Sunday from 7 a.m. Well, not from, but at 7 a.m. and p.m. and 1 a.m. on Monday mornings. We're archived at richarddugan.com, and we stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. Stay tuned. We have more coming up. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Joe White. He is the founder, executive director, and the visionary of 2020, A Year Without War. That is the website, ayearwithoutwar.org, where you can go in and you can check out the videos, check out the staff, check out Indiegogo.com, I believe it is, and donate, support. Again, a latte or two, or a breakfast or a lunch or a dinner somewhere, 20, 30 bucks, it's no big deal. It wasn't that hard for me to do, so I know it's not that hard for you to do. So do what you can. And again, you answered the question where the money goes. It's to support the staff financially so that they can do the kind of work that needs to be done over the next 6 years, 5 years, actually, 5 years, and hopefully we can bring this about. I want to step back a little bit into history, because there is a document that was, I don't know if the right word is ratified, it was at least drawn up, and has been in place since, if I'm not correct, shortly after World War I, that basically abolishes all war. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's called the Pact of Paris, or the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And what happened after World War I, as people were just drawn into that war, given all the crazy alliances that were in place at the time. And somewhat ironically, we alluded to the Christmas Eve truce of 1914, when in Belgium, the British forces and the German forces finally on Christmas Eve just went into no man's land and greeted each other. Some even said they played a little soccer or football amongst each other. But at that time, with that Christmas Eve truce, part of the account was that they were realizing they weren't going to be home for Christmas. Both sides seemed to think that the conflict, which I believe started in August of 1914, would be over by Christmas. Nobody realized it was going to take until 1918, and so many millions of people would die as a result of this. So during the 1920s, in the U.S., there grew up what was known as the outlawry movement, which was an attempt on the part of churches and academicians and professionals and students to simply outlaw war. And let's not draw distinctions between defensive and offensive wars. Let's just take it off the books. Mm. And we know that there's going to be international conflict, but let's put courts in place and let's use courts to arbitrate these conflicts and not go to war anymore. Well, as we know, part of the Versailles Treaty was so lopsided and horrific for the losers that it instigated what then came to be World War II. But by the early 1930s, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, or the Pact of Paris, had been passed in 1928, and by the 1930s, over 60 of the major nations of the world had signed on to the pact, and none of them have rescinded it since then. So it's still on the books in the United States and most of the world powers now, at least those 60 countries. So what we're trying to do is to remind the world that we did that in 1928, that we signed this pact saying, my gosh, what have we just done to each other? What a wound we have inflicted upon ourselves with World War One, and let's not do that again. And, you know, kind of as we mentioned earlier with slavery, there are these attempts. You keep pushing forward and pushing forward. But, you know, back then there wasn't the technology we have today, and Kellogg-Briand was another top-down attempt. Frank Kellogg was Secretary of State, and interestingly, the pact, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, as it came to be known, grew out of the Republican administrations of the 1920s. Not that they had fully embraced it. It was still kind of bottom-up movement, but they did react and finally signed it in 1928. And Briand was a minister in France at the time. But what we're trying to do is just give the voice to everybody. Everybody now, it can just simply come to the website and say, yeah, I'd like to see this. Which, again, for us is to remind people that this isn't so much about the feasibility of this at this point. This is about, would you like to see a year without war?
Mm-hmm.
And if you would like to see that, just vote yes. That's all you have to do. Yeah. We'll take care of the feasibility thing as this continues to unfold, because as the choir builds, the chorus could become quite commanding.
It's interesting because, as you say, this isn't about saying this is, it's like, we're not putting up demands here. You're not putting up any kind of demands. You're not saying, we want 1 year without war. That's what we want. No, well, it's more... You're putting that question out there in the minds of the public to start with. That's the starting point. What would that be like? Or as the little PSA I'd created, what would it sound like?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be silence, peace and silence, or children playing in a playground, or music, or the ocean surf, or whatever peaceful sounds, if you want to use that term, would mean to you, because we don't know. We know what sunlight is like, both in the summer and the winter. We know what snowstorms and hail, we know what earthquakes and wildfires, especially here on the Central Coast, are like. But the majority of us, I would probably say, if not all the people on the planet, have no clue as to what a period of time, and in this case a year, would be like if there was no war. So it's a contemplative question that you're putting forth.
And we would like people to have maybe a comparable feeling, if people are listening, if they remember Y2K.
Oh, yes.
1999, oh, New Lord. Year's Eve, you know, for the
I
year
could tell
2000.
You stories.
Yeah. And
you know,
globally, people
were
wondered.
Freaking out.
Yeah. So we don't want people to freak out, but
no.
We would like the planet to be collectively on December 31st, 2019, saying, is it going to work? Is it going to happen?
Yeah.
Is this the year? And then to have that kind of anticipation, collective anticipation that we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see now how this unfolds. That's what we're trying to build up to.
Have you seen any other time in history? And actually, I will share an example, but have you seen any time in history where anything like this has ever been done, not necessarily on a global scale, because we've never had the global connectivity that we do today, but on a regional or national level where the people said, we want something different. We want to experience something different.
I'd have to give that a little thought, but we are in the midst of the holiday season,
mm-hmm.
and this has always been one of my favorite times of the year,
mm-hmm.
because it always seemed as I was growing up that once Thanksgiving passed, something was coming to you.
Yeah.
And it was the holidays.
Yeah.
And you knew your work patterns were going to change. You knew families were going to migrate and attempt to get together. There was going to be frivolity. There was going to be good food. And there was going to be a kind of joy that wasn't wasn't there in the same way in February.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this is kind of like that. I mean, Christmas is very broad globally. You know, I suspect it's not a big deal in China, but
not
you know,
yet.
Well, you know, and I have to say, I just don't know.
We don't know what it is. Exactly.
But I know in this part of the world and parts of Europe, while it's variously celebrated differently, nonetheless, there's a kind of spirit of the times.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the United States, things change on July 4th. There are parades, you know, whatever else is going on, July 4th is a special time for the United States of America. Nobody asks you what your religion is. Nobody asks if you're Republican or Democrat. It's a civic holiday, mm-hmm. and you get together for the fireworks, the barbecues, or whatever, and people find that sense of patriotism that lifts their spirits mm-hmm. in that way. And I think a year without war has the potential for that kind of collective experience mm. because I think a majority of people are so opposed to war. I mean, they had the choice because, again, as we watch ISIS move through Syria and Iraq, we realize that the combatants are always a minority compared to the refugees, which are a majority.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the refugees have never had a voice. And now, for you know, what if we can get out there, and we've had wonderful contacts with people in Jordan, Amman, who've brought a year without war there to some of the schools, and they've just embraced this so wholeheartedly, which is in part why we need the staff. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's been wonderful working with student volunteers,
sure.
and they will continue to be at the heart of this thing. But at this juncture, we have not only our Pact of Paris petition going to the United Nations to say, please, let's make August 27th a global holiday. Let's recognize when our grandparents were even more radical than we are at this point. We're just asking for a year without war.
Yeah.
Our grandparents in 1928 managed to say, no, we're getting rid of it. It's off the table at this point. So we want August 27th recognized as Pact of Paris Day, when our grandparents actually outlawed war. And let's see if we can't rethink some of the thinking that went into that, and maybe that's where we should be. We also have three other proclamations going, or petitions going to the United Nations. So anybody's interested, please come to our website. You can sign the petitions at change.org. In the next few months, we should have them up at other petition sites. So support us. We would like to actually, one of the other petitions we're putting forth is to recognize September 20th as the International Memorial Day. No matter what side of a war you were on, you lost people.
Yeah,
and so let's make September 20th the International Memorial Day, where we think back of all the loss that we've experienced through war. Because as we also mentioned a moment ago, September 21st is the International Day of Peace. So we think those two together would give us first a day of reflection on our losses, and then September 21st would be a day that we can actually celebrate how much peace that we can bring about in the world.
When I think about the various wars that have been raging on and off over the last 40 or 50 years that I've been around, I am saddened more by the lost potential than anything else. What would these people have contributed to our respective societies, wherever they came from, had they lived, had they not been involved? And I often wonder, what would happen, and this is a whole sidebar off of this business of a 2020, a year without war, if all of the members of a respective military force one day collectively just said, no, we're not going to fight anymore. We're done. We're not going to, this is ridiculous, you know. And I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that one of the reasons why a lot of these conflicts, aside from trying to get the treasures from the other side, there's the patriotic aspect to it, you know, that they're fighting for freedom and liberty, whether it's the U.S. or some other country, and freedom and all of these wonderful terms that we hear all the time, and yet we're still fighting. And so I ask the question, did all of these people down through the years die for nothing? And at least up to this moment, the observation, I would think, would be, yes, they all died for nothing because we're still fighting. And the day we stop, be it January 1st of 2020 or sooner, is the day that we honor them by stopping the conflict, by stopping the fighting. And even if it is only for 364 more days after that, so be it. Consider that possibility.
You know, the war over our history is so complicated. Sometimes World War II is referred to as the last unambiguous war. You know, when you
Because you knew your enemy, you knew where they lived, you knew where to find them.
And they're practicing industrial genocide.
Yeah.
And they're simply attacking their neighbors and you know, which is not unlike what ISIS is doing now.
Sure, but we can't pin them down to
It's a place. An insurgency. Yeah, they
exactly.
don't quite wear the same sort of brilliant uniforms the Nazis developed. And, you know, and there's all that twisted, complicated history.
Yeah.
But when we come to the wars of today, it doesn't seem to be quite Caesar looking for his triumph in Rome.
Yeah.
But it seems as though we fight, both sides fight for peace. Now, we may define what those conditions of peace are, but part of what 2020 wants to say is, can we kind of skip this first step?
Yeah.
Can't we just skip the war part and go to the peace part? But there's divisiveness over the peace, and there's a tendency, I think, presently for this deep difference between homogeneous societies and in more heterogeneous societies, which and the heterogeneous are the ones that are going to be able to tolerate the diversity of pluralism. And while, you know, it strikes me, and I'm not a close student of this, but it strikes me that a group like ISIS desires to homogenize the culture. And I think the present regime that rules Iran, again, has this desire to homogenize their society in a conservative Shia manner. And the pressures internal to Iran, which we've seen in the last few elections, particularly the last election of Ahmadinejad, shows that it's a complex society particularly of young people that want greater tolerance for diversity.
Yeah.
And these are some pretty core values. And, you know, when it comes to these very deep values in this way, 2020, a year without war, is not neutral in an important sense. I think it is on the side of pluralism and trying to find stability in the midst of all this diversity, as we said previously. And when you impose such homogeneity upon the large societies we have living under conditions of globalization, the deep conflicts are just inevitable.
You know, using that word pluralism, when I worked for 15 years for a Christian radio station and I heard the messages constantly, the thing that didn't make any sense to me was that when it came to, for example, food, there was a plurality. I'm just going to use that term of foods that you could eat and drink, plurality, education, plurality, type of career, plurality. The list went on and on. But when it came to religion and your soul, singularity, only one. And I'm going, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. It was illogical to me.
Well, if you back up a little bit, for example, you being working for a Christian organization, perhaps raised Christian as well.
Mm-hmm, Catholic, uh-huh.
You know, there was diversity in food to an extent. But when I was growing up Christian, Catholic, on Fridays you didn't eat meat.
No fish. Oh, meat. It was meat. You ate fish, not meat. Right.
And Catholics don't tolerate polygamy, though we know that's broadly practiced on planet Earth. And we know they're still having problems with gay people. There's still a huge issue with abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all of these limits. But that's what defines them as the community that they are.
Right, right.
But when you live in a country as complex as the United States or any, you know, medium-sized dry good country on earth at this time, if you force them into what you'd call the singularity or into a more homogenous existence, mm-hmm. conflict inevitably comes up. And then you become repressive. So if you go back in the history of the Catholic Church, because of that inability to tolerate diversity, you ended up with the Inquisition.
Yeah.
And our big question is, do we learn from these lessons in history? And can we say, in an important sense, that for human beings, history is unfolding in terms of greater and greater diversity?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. can we say that this diversity is actually healthy, giving us a pluralistic culture in the way in which we avoid monoculture agriculturally, that we don't want a singularity amongst human beings? Though that is a deep desire that we have, and we could talk about aspects of this in terms of human beings being rendered, in a sense, untethered from reality, because it's these big systems that give you a sense of where you are in reality. And if you have to tolerate diversity, you have to also accept that you may be mistaken about things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if you are mistaken, and if we have evolved as hunters and gatherers in a predator-prey world, ignorance can sometimes be quite lethal. And I think it's grown to such levels in Homo sapien or human beings in their cultures that for most of our history, rather than facing that diversity and tolerating it, it was easier just to eliminate or co-op the other.
Yeah.
And largely, you really didn't have to deal with that much diversity because travel wasn't like it is today.
Exactly.
There was no rapid transportation. It took you, you know, a month or so to get across the Atlantic. Yeah. Now it's a couple hours.
Yeah.
Or your Conestoga across the prairie.
It's extraordinary to just contemplate. I live up above Santa Barbara, up on the hill, adjacent to the Highway 154. I'm at the summit. And there are periods of time, and it's the closest example I can come up with. There are periods of time, especially in the very early morning hours, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, when there isn't a car on that highway for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. And it is so quiet. It is so peaceful. And I liken that to this whole question. What would that be like, 2020, a year without war? For 15 or 20 or 30 minutes, it would be so quiet and peaceful. And you'd get more of those 15 and 20 and 30 minute stretches between the small space of cars that would go by. And maybe that's kind of where we're at, is that's what we're looking at, is because we've said this before, and I'm sure it'll be said many, many times in the future. We don't know what that's like, and we'd like to experience that.
Well,
and we may not like it. I mean, that would be weird, very weird if somehow, some way, I don't like this. This just doesn't feel right. Well, in the beginning, it probably wouldn't feel right.
It would be a little odd. Yeah. And I think I'm going to maybe take that as an indication I should stay up later until 3 or 4 in the morning, since I'm usually not up at that time to experience the world in that way. But I have been in places where it has been so quiet that it is unnerving.
Yeah.
You know, that this program could do that would be an experience well worth having. I remember when I was very young, 8, 9 years old, and I was with my family, and my parents were visiting with some of their friends, and they put the kids off in a room to watch TV, and a bunch of the other kids went to play games, and I was watching TV, and a Walter Cronkite show on World War II came on, and they were showing, it's the first I'd seen images from the concentration camps, and they were the iconic images of trailers heaped with corpses and just piles of bodies. And as a kid, it just it shocked me, and I cried, and I just couldn't. It touched me so deeply to think that what had all these people done? What was this thing? Because you know, I didn't know World War II. I was just a kid, but it was just unsettling to me. And there's something about my character that seems so sensitive to images of war, particularly when the innocent are killed. Yeah. And I've had the good fortune of the last couple of years with this program of meeting people who have played very big roles in our recent history. This last fall, we had Kim Fook here, who's the young lady in the iconic Vietnam photo that was napalmed. And her message she brought was the notion of forgiveness. And the year before, we had Paul Rusesa Baguina here, who was the fellow portrayed in the film Hotel Rwanda. Mm. And at that time, his autobiography was, I think it was called An Ordinary Man, about how ordinary people kind of step up and just in extraordinary circumstances can do extraordinary things.
Yeah.
And, you know, these people just, they just touch me in a way that, you know, A Year Without War is just my attempt or my thought of just what can I leave behind here? Could there be this perfect pause for humanity in which we actually tip history?
Yeah.
And people say, oh my gosh, we just had that moment where we weren't worried about mortars. The snipers were gone. The children played outdoors.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you played your opening music and sounds, it was the sound of those children, all those children's voices. That's what I would like to hear.
Well, I would like to hear your answer to my final three questions as we come to the end of our program. And I thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us here on Tell Me Your Story.
Thank you.
Who is Joe White?
First question. Ordinary average guy. I mean, with a name like that, you know, I just fade. Joe White. Well, right now, I'm the executive director of A Year Without War and have the daily pleasure of just working with some astonishing people who are on this team who've come together and have volunteered their time. I also serve as the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Santa Barbara City College and have been blessed with working at, as you well know, what was voted upon by the Aspen Institute last year to be the number one community college in the United States of America.
Yeah.
It has a beautiful location. I get to walk to my classes along the ocean and see the harbor and the mountains. And I've had just great students these years. I usually end up with 450 or so students every semester wanting to study philosophy. Mm. So that's been a wonderful part of my professional life. I became chair of the department in 1991. So it's been a wonderful run up there. I have a family. I have two great kids who have the sense of adventure that seems to run through my immediate family. And they're on their way back now, so they'll be here for the holidays. We always come together. And I have two parents.
You've answered this question throughout the interview, but the pointed question would be, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
There are a couple things. I was on sabbatical a few years back, and I was wanting to work in an area, write a book in an area known as erotetic logic. And erotetic logic, it's not prominently taught, and what is taught tends to be highly formal. And what is taught when you take a logic class in college is inferential logic. And I don't know if you've studied any logic, mm-hmm. but it's you study the structure of argument and what makes for a good argument, what makes for a bad argument. So you spend time talking about deductive arguments, validity, soundness, and inductive arguments, and strength and probability. But in the world of erotetic logic, the focus is upon questions. And there's a certain logic to questions, because if you want to solve a problem, you've got to make sure you've asked the right question.
Mm.
And if you ask the wrong question, you can simply go, you'll just go off, and you can, and human beings have spent centuries off the mark. And a couple of the issues that, problems that fascinated me, and I'll just talk about one, but one was the bubonic plague in the 14th century when it finally arrived in Western Europe. And because Western European culture was in a very important way predominantly religious, particularly in the Christian sense of religion, when the plague hit, the popular reaction was to ask, why are we being punished by our God? Why is this happening? And then you start to see what answers are going to be forthcoming.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to have to find the sinners. You're going to have to do more sacrifice, all that stuff. It wasn't the dominant view that this is an infection, a bacterial infection,
right.
caused by, you know, XYZ and the rats and fleas and that whole story. That took a couple centuries to figure out. Mm. So they didn't ask the right question. And what you find amongst human beings is sometimes the inability to question their own questions. It makes us insecure. And so as we were talking a moment ago about homogeneous societies lending themselves to a greater sense of kind of existential security because you're on the right path, you know the truth, particularly if you go into religious contexts where the truths are so big, they're big eternal truths,
right.
Everybody
yeah.
else is wrong. You know, those lend yeah. itself to a lot of just existential security. So I wanted to work in this area of aerotetic logic and put together more of an informal book for undergraduate students, the way we see we have so many texts now on informal logic, but it's inferential logic. And so I started working in that area, but I realized that with my students, they don't like to ask questions to begin with. They kind of sit there, bright-eyed, college, and you say, who's got a question? And in a philosophy class, and they're waiting for somebody, and you see them. And after talking and being in the world of academia for a couple decades, the consensus was that people don't like to appear ignorant or stupid.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want other people to think they don't know, which is somewhat ironic if you're in a classroom to learn things.
Yeah.
Everybody knows you don't know. That's why you're there.
Exactly.
but you hide in silence and waiting for, or the worst part is to think you're stupid. So I realized that if I wanted to do work in aerotetic logic, somehow I had to deal with this obstacle of shame in the face of people thinking you're ignorant or stupid.
Right.
So I started looking at ignorance and stupidity, and I ended up not writing the book on an aerotetic logic, but instead putting together a primer on ignorance and stupidity. And in particular, not the sort of itemizing, as people say, well, what did you end up doing? I said, well, I put together this book and this primer on ignorance and stupidity. Well, I know who you could really talk about. I know so many stupid people. But it's not about that. And what developed was the thesis that there's much value in ignorance and stupidity, both prudential value, moral value, and aesthetic value. And the prudential value is that we as a species would not live under conditions of civilization if we weren't ignorant and stupid. The irony is it's our ignorance and stupidity that require complex divisions of labor, which are required for civilization. Because if we were all brilliant and knew everything, we wouldn't need each other. But we realize we need each other. I mean, I couldn't even tell you where my clothes come from that I'm wearing, let alone make clothes like this,
right.
or my car that I'm driving,
right.
or I don't know the history of this building. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm so surrounded by ignorance. I walked outside last night to take our dog out, and I looked up at this brilliant, clear sky and Orion's High, and I just realized
there's
so much I just don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I could be with my astronomy colleagues, and they're going to point out all the stars, and they're going to tell me where they're located, what they're made up of, what they're doing, what the red giants are, all that sort of stuff. But I'm just surrounded by all this ignorance, and then it was fascinating. In academia, there's the term cognitive closure, which means you just can't think certain thoughts.
Right.
And we have these collectively, where we're a species that may not be able to think certain thoughts. But when you reflect upon your own condition, you realize there are just certain things you can't think, and you don't know how to do those things. Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter of time and practice, though some of my colleagues argue, yes, it is. You could do that, Joe, if you just took enough time. No, I couldn't do that. And so the cognitive closure is the stupidity. And it's okay to get to know yourself to find out where your pockets of stupidity are.
Yeah.
And you can admire the talent that other people have to navigate through that and the contribution that they then make to civilization. And it was out of that book, that primer on ignorance and stupidity, that 2020, A Year Without War, grew.
I love the definition of those two words. Ignorance is you don't know.
But could.
And stupidity is you do know, and yet you still do the other thing. Well, you know that you shouldn't do.
That puts it in the realm of acting. And my use of it in terms of cognitive closure is you don't know and you can't know.
Ah.
There's just so many, as I've looked at this and myself, if I was honored to be asked to play Hamlet mm-hmm. in a play at our Garvin Theater, I couldn't do it.
Yeah,
I can't memorize the play. My brain doesn't work that way. And I'm just cognitively closed to being able to do that. And if I could memorize it, I'm cognitively closed to acting. I couldn't create a believable character.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you start mm-hmm. looking at, particularly in academia, and all the departments and all the specialties, the vastness of one's ignorance is breathtaking.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you talk to the people who are doing work in these areas, you start to realize that, I'm thankful I have these chemists, these physicists, these mathematicians, these historians, and all these people, because there's certain thoughts I cannot have.
Yeah. I have to say the same. Very grateful for all of the plurality.
Yes.
The plurality that's out there. Who inspires you?
Who inspires me? First thing came to my mind was my family. I have such great kids, and my wife. You know, she has, through all this. This has been to be at the school, as busy as that school is, as wonderful as it is, and then try to pull off the building from a simple idea mm-hmm. to, you know, as I mentioned before, we're over 30,000 people from 120 nations, and this has all been volunteer work on the part of a whole lot, actually generations, because City College is a 2-year school. I still have people who started at the very beginning. Good old Josh is still with me, mm-hmm. but, you know, the other people go on in their education, so we have different generations to hold that together and keep it moving in the same direction. She has devoted herself to keeping me alive, my wife. She said, that's my purpose right now. I just need to keep you alive.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
She's done. Yeah. I mean, so it's so inspiring to be loved.
Yeah.
You know, to feel that in your life. And now with the holidays, my kid's anxious to come back. Intellectually, I come out of the world of philosophy. And intellectually, I would say most of this work of mine comes out of the work of John Rawls. And I don't even know if you've ever heard of John Rawls, but he died in probably 2002, 2004, I want to say, around through there, maybe later. But he, when I was in graduate school, published one of the most popular books in political philosophy in the late 20th century. It was called A Theory of Justice. And in 1990, he published another work called Political Liberalism, in which he had discovered there's a huge problem in his original work. And the original work, A Theory of Justice, came out in the 1970s. I mean, it swept through philosophy, economics, a lot of different disciplines. And he realized there's a significant contradiction at the heart of his work. And so he rewrote large parts of its conceptual foundation. Mm-hmm. And attempting to follow his thought, because he's obviously much brighter than I am, but attempting to follow that thought and to understand. And really, for him, and what I learned from him, was this evolving notion of historical pluralism and the ability to articulate a rational foundation of stability that even people who profoundly disagree mm-hmm. can nonetheless find justice within a society and have public reasoning that we can, that gives us kind of overlapping consensus, and we can disagree as Catholics or Protestants or Hindus or libertarians and progressives or Republicans and Democrats, but there's still, you can still avoid war.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to that level of conflict. And but then again, there are those amongst us that, you know, we have people out there that are shooting abortion doctors and, you know, show up at, you know, gay marriages and disrupt people. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program and enlightening us further on 2020, A Year Without War. Encourage our listeners to go to ayearwithoutwar.org, find out all there is to know about this project, about this this concept, if you will, and ask themselves that very question. What would it be like? Just imagine, what would it be like?
I thank you for having me on the show as well, Richard. And when this is broadcast, we'll be heading toward the tail end of our Indiegogo fundraiser. So anybody out there that would like to see this global social experiment unfold, please just, a lot of you, give us a little and join us, and let's see what the globe wants here in the early 21st century.
I mean, what have we got to lose?
You have nothing to lose.
Absolutely.
And everything to gain, I think.
Yeah.
Joe, and plus the excitement.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Joe, once again, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Once again, that's aworldwithoutwar.org or indiegogo.com. You can contribute and support A World Without War 2020. A year without war. A year without war, and maybe we will have a world without. That's another project for another time. A year without war, and we're looking at 2020. Until next time, love to all.